Jesus has described the Christian's character, then the Christian's influence, and finally the Christian's righteousness. This is as far as we have travelled through the Sermon on the Mount. He describes the Christian's character in the first 11 verses of chapter 5, the so-called Beatitudes. There is the Christian, and there is the Christian life and the Christian's growth. He has described the Christian's influence in this world in terms of salt and light, not sugar and spice, but salt and light. And he's described the Christian's righteousness as a righteousness which exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Not that it's to be more of the same, but that it must be different and it must be deeper, because the righteousness of the follower of Jesus Christ must arise from within, from the heart. The character, the influence, and the righteousness of the Christian. Now, having dealt with these three great areas in the first 20 verses, the rest of chapter 5 of Matthew is given to examples and illustrations of this deeper Christian righteousness. Six times over, Jesus takes these startling statements and he illustrates them. Now, the startling statements are these: "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And secondly, "Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Six times Jesus illustrates this then. Three times taking commandments from the law, and three times taking areas of life which are already addressed in the Old Testament. And he shows how he, Jesus, deepens the law of God, but does not destroy it for all who follow him. Now, this morning we're going to try to deal as quickly as possible with the first two of these. Now, if I take a long time to deal with the first, don't panic. Your potatoes will not be turned to mush. I will deal with the second one as quickly as I can. First of them is anger. Now, people say it's about killing. It's not. It's about anger. Anger rather than killing, because Jesus points immediately to the inner source of the problem, not to the outer action, which is its symptom. He points to the heart before the action. This is the way Jesus deepens the law of God. Now, the question of the taking of life in war, and the other question of taking life as a penalty for certain crimes, so-called capital punishment, is not in view here, and Jesus does not deal with these questions. The word kill, both in the New Testament and in the Old Testament's language, is much better rendered murder. And if you're reading New International Version this morning, you'll see that it grasps the nettle and uses the word murder. Because that's what's in view. Unlawful taking of life in anger. However, since this inevitably always arises, this question of a just war and capital punishment, when we come to these words, let's just deal with them briefly to set them aside. There's never a time when this is not relevant. And bearing in mind what's going on in the Balkans just now, it's very relevant for us. It's always relevant. It was relevant in the time of the crisis in the East. It was relevant in the time of the Falklands Islands. It's always relevant because there's always war in the world. The whole question of a just war and the question also of a death penalty is a vexed and difficult one. Now, people say it's easier for you Christians. It is not. It is an even more difficult question for the Christian. And while there are sincerely held opposite views on both sides of both fences in the world, there are also sincerely held opposite views amongst Christians too. But neither the commandment, "You shall not kill," nor the teaching of Jesus here is a total prohibition on the taking of life under any circumstances. Now that's a fact. The fact is that these two issues are simply not addressed here. If the concept of a just war, and if the concept of the death penalty are justifiable, then this is not the grounds upon which you justify them. Neither can you ever justify them on the grounds that human life is cheap. No one has ever done that. The opposite reason is given. It is because human life is precious that it must not be taken lightly. Because even fallen man bears the image of God, there must be no careless taking of life. Now that came long before even the law of God is given in the scriptures. It was to Noah, not Moses, that God said, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed. For God made man in his own image." And those who are passionately against capital punishment on the grounds that human life, that is the murderous human life, is precious, should be ready to see that it's the preciousness of human life that is the ground of those who argue that the state should take the life of a murderer. I'm not falling down on one side or the other of this argument. I'm saying that it's the same ground that's given and taken for both arguments, both views. And in the same way, when you speak about pacifism, unconditional pacifism is a stance taken on the grounds of the preciousness of human life. But those who believe in a just war also argue from the same ground, saying that without a just war, then wickedness would be rampant. And wicked people would rule the whole earth without interruption. Now these are vexed and complicated questions. You remember that a couple of years ago, we were asked to sign something from the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland on the Middle East hostilities. Many of us, myself included, couldn't sign it, simply because of the complexity of the question. However, your heart goes out to those who suffer in war. It's a difficult area, and it can't be solved in a simplistic way, and it mustn't be solved by taking the words of Jesus here and using them in a wrong way. What Jesus says here has nothing to do with capital punishment, and nothing to do with war, just or not. And you and I won't come to grips with what Jesus is saying here until we refuse to be sidetracked by these questions. Set them all on one side and allow Christ to speak. Anger is what is being addressed. Anger, it is perfectly clear, is what the scribes and the Pharisees did not address when they looked at the law of God. They restricted the commandments to the deed alone, to the act of murder. And if anyone could get through life without actually taking a human life, even accidentally, then according to the Pharisees, that man had kept the sixth commandment. And Jesus says, no. Jesus says that the proper application was both wider and deeper. And so Jesus includes thoughts and words as well as the action. This is why he speaks of anger, the thought, and insult, the words, as well as the action here. These words, without a cause, that we took in from the footnote, from the bottom of the page of the RSV, well, they're in most of the manuscripts, and it's a good thing that they're there, because they point us to something that is important. Jesus here is speaking, about anger that's extended to people, a hostility towards other, a spite towards other that is without just cause. He is speaking not about what Luther calls the anger of love, where you're angry at the action and the wrong and the hurt it does, but you're not angry at the person. He is speaking about the anger that is spiteful and selfish and proud. He is speaking about hatred, which is, he says, within the heart, a murder. You'll notice that it's not once, but four times he uses the word brother here. Anger with a brother. Slander against a brother. Calling a brother your fool, and so on. This is what Jesus identifies as breaking the command not to murder. It's something that begins within us. It's an emotion, and it's an attitude within us. Anger within the Christian against another can be a terrible thing in the church. A feud, a resentment, a bitterness that's held onto and nursed and nurtured within the heart is a terrible thing. Remember Burns's words, nursing a wrath to keep it warm. But we can do that. This is what Jesus is referring to. It's a terrible thing in the Church of Christ to see people angry with each other and unwilling to deal with it. And even more unwilling to forgive. Murderous anger is what Jesus is dealing with. And he goes on to speak of it in terms of the tongue. You know what James says about the tongue? He says many things. With the tongue, he says, we bless the Lord and Father. And with the tongue, we curse men who are made in the likeness of God. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers, says James. He who speaks evil against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. And the law you see there in James is clearly brought into line with the love of God. Jesus includes what we say. What we say about and against each other in moments of anger. Paul puts it like this. The whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you are not consumed by one another. You see, there are those who are caught up into this. They are angry and they think they are justified in their anger. And they are not. We are not justified in holding on to our spite. There are people who have heard things and taken them out of context, who are holding grudges against other people, and they don't see that they are inhibiting their own spiritual life and growth, and they are inhibiting the peace of the Church of Jesus Christ. We are to stop this. We are not to insult one another. The original word is raka. You maybe get that from the footnote in your Bible as well. You are not to say that word to another. Literally, it means that you're calling the person a moron. Isn't it amazing how many words we have in English that come so quickly to mind when we want to call someone down? Moron, idiot, twit, fool, so on. You're not to call the man raka. You're not to call him a rebel, more, a fool, says RSV. That is, you're not to make him an outcast. That's the foundation of that word. Now, there's all the difference in the world between allowing someone who has backslidden from Christ to go and pushing someone out in judgment from the Church of God. This is what's being addressed by Paul and James, and this is something that these words of Jesus address. We are not to expel other Christians in anger and in resentment. Tasker calls that telling a brother he is going to hell and so being more in danger of hell yourself. You see, to say raka, to call a man stupid, is to have contempt for his mind. And to call him mori is to have contempt for the man's heart, is to call him bad. And both, says Jesus, are springing from hatred. He who hates his brother, says John, is a murderer. Jesus extends and he deepens this, you see, beyond the action to the thoughts of the heart. Now Jesus takes two positive and practical things and sets them before us as guidance as to what to do when we find things are wrong between one Christian and another, between ourselves and another. He sets down two illustrations, the illustration of going to worship and the illustration of going, or rather being taken to the court. To come right to the heart of this, Jesus is still speaking about hatred within us. He is saying that even when you are not the one doing the hating, but when you are the one who is hated for some reason, if you know it, do something about it. And if you're responsible for it, if you've given cause, if you're guilty, then go and make peace with the one you have offended. Go and be reconciled, says Jesus, or at least try it. The implication is clear. If you're not reconciled with your Christian brother or sister, if you're not reconciled to the one you have wronged or offended in some way, then you are not right with God. We see that over and over again in God's word. You cannot say you love God if you hate your brother. Now, the other picture is different. It's a picture of the law. This is not a brother but an enemy. But the same is this, that Jesus says you must take action and you must take it immediately. It is urgent. Put it right. Put it right now. Be reconciled. Be reconciled now. That's the Christian's righteousness in regard to anger. Now we have the Christian's righteousness in regard to lust. People say this is about adultery. It's not. Adultery is the symptom of the inner problem, which is one of lust. The scribes and the Pharisees, again, you see, emptied the seventh commandment as they emptied the sixth by an apparently strict limiting of its range and application. They said as long as you could avoid sexual impurity and adultery in their narrow definition, then you'd kept the seventh commandment. They restricted it to sexual activity. Presumably they ignored the tenth commandment, which points out that to covet a man's wife is also a sin. There you see, even in the ten commandments themselves, an indicator that it's the inner life that matters firstly. To them Jesus says no. The heart and the mind once more are included. Now, nowhere is the natural sexual relationship within marriage and built upon fidelity and faithfulness downgraded. Nowhere in the scriptures. Jesus here is referring to unlawful sexual activity outside marriage, but he's also pointing into our hearts and minds. What he is saying is clear and radical. And he's pointing to practical and positive steps we can take to be free from this. And he uses the figure, and bear in mind it is a figure, of plucking out the eye and cutting off the hand that leads to sin. Can you imagine what kind of a world this would be for us as human beings if we didn't have imagination? Can you imagine what kind of a wilderness it would be without imagination and music and art, in literature and drama, and in worship? Not that we worship an imaginary God, but that we use our sanctified imaginations in visualizing the greatness of God. Can you imagine a world without imagination? Well, Jesus is dealing here with our imaginations. when your eyes and your heart following lead you to sin, do something about your inner life, says Jesus. Do you remember Job, when he was questioned about whether he was bringing punishment upon himself, said, yes, it's possible that my eye upon another man's wife has led me in my heart to go to another man's door. He said, it's possible that my imagination leads to an emotional state, leads to an action which is sin. God help me, says Job. Now that's the same picture that Jesus has here. The eye and the heart leading to the action. Imagination and then the feelings leading to the action. The eye, says Bunyan, is a sentry to the soul. And so it is. And Jesus says here, if your sentry lets you down, do something about it. Do something about your imagination. Now, you see, what Jesus is saying is, if there is offense coming in your life, do something about the place from which the offense arises. Pluck out the eye. Get rid of the hand that offends you. Listen to what he says later in Matthew chapter 18. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life maimed or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. He says it again, you see, in chapter 18. He includes there the foot. So that now we have the mind and the imagination and the eye. We have the actions in the hand, and we have going to the very location and the circumstances in the foot, Matthew 18. If you can't look at certain things without being wrongly stimulated, says Jesus, don't look. Isn't it possible for us to sit in front of those televisions and ours, and provided there's no one else there to embarrass us, we are prepared to sit and watch things that somehow we know are wrong stimulations? We wouldn't let children watch them. There are some things on our televisions that we shouldn't let ourselves watch. I'm convinced of it. If there are certain things that wrongly stimulate you, don't look. If you can't do certain things and remain under control, don't do them. If you can't go to certain places, if you can't be in certain events without being tempted, don't go, says Jesus. Now there were those who took this in entirely the wrong way. There was Origen of Alexandria, for example, who took Matthew 5 and Matthew 18, and then he looked into Matthew 19, you know, about sexual purity, and he actually mutilated himself. In the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 had to forbid this foolishness. It's literalism. And literalism is not a deeper obedience, it's a shallow obedience. No, this is about the mind, the heart, leading to actions. If you can't look, don't look. If you can't do, don't do. If you can't be there, don't go if these things are leading you into temptation. It might well be that there are certain things which are neutral and all right, but which lead certain people into temptation. If that is so, then even if they are legitimate and neutral, then they must be cut off. That's what the figure is speaking of. It may be that there are certain Christians who have to live a less liberated life. John Stott calls them culturally maimed. But better to be one-eyed and one-handed and faithful to Christ than to go against conscience and to fail to enter your rest. Better than to have two eyes and be lost is to be one-eyed and faithful. It's a figure, do you see? Living in this world with the sight of the next world to guide us, this is what it's about. Not all disciples have to give up exactly the same things. But we all know there are things in our lives which, in obedience to Christ, we have to let go or even cut off for His sake. Now, that is not mutilation. That is mortification. Mortification, according to Romans and Galatians and Colossians, mortification is about dying to yourself in the death of Jesus Christ upon the cross. That is not mutilation. The enemy of our souls says to us, "Oh, these Christians are all poor souls. Look at them, they've got to mutilate themselves and deny their humanity." It's not so. It is mortification, not mutilation. There can be times when, in obedience to Christ, there has to be a kind of inner amputation. Now, that amputation does not make us less for Christ's sake. It makes us more for His sake. It makes us whole in His service. Now, I'm conscious of the fact, let me say this in closing, I'm very conscious of the fact that this goes against the popular philosophy of our society today. The message that's being pumped out, the message that underlies everything that's being pumped out today, seems to be, if you want it, take it. If you like it, do it. Nobody can stop you. Now, that is not Christian. The Christian philosophy is mortification. Not what you want, but what Christ wants. Not what we like, but what Christ wants for us is our very best. And we begin with the question as Christians, what can I do for Christ? Not, what can Christ do for me? I'm conscious that this is against the philosophy of our world. But frankly, I'd rather be like Jacob and limp my way through life, because God had to cripple the man, than walk with a perfect gait in disobedience. Wouldn't you? I would rather follow Christ than follow the crowd. Is this negative and narrow? It's only negative, and it only seems to be narrow when you view it from the outside, when you judge it by the standards and values of a world which is estranged from God and ignorant of Christ. But this is the positive way. And this is Jesus' great-hearted answer to our anger. Love for Him. Love for our brothers. Love, as we shall see later, even for our enemies, is the positive antidote. And this is taking up the cross and following Christ. We'll have more to say about this when we gather together this evening. This is following Christ, not following the crowd. This we are called to do. Oh, for a heart to praise my God. The hymn number 467 in closing.